an American, a Canadian, and a Brit walk into a bar. But this isn't a bad joke. This is Ladies of Valhalla.
And welcome to Ladies of Valhalla. My name is Sarah and I'll be your host today. I'd like to welcome you all to this latest member of the Talking Comics podcast family. This month we'll be taking a dive into the 2017 Boom Studios comics miniseries Lady Castle from Delilah S. Dawson, Ashley A. Woods, Becca Farrow, Rebecca Nalty and Jim Campbell. But first off, please allow me to introduce my wonderful co-hosts. In alphabetical order, we have the Boudica of Brunch, the Stimula of Stardew Valley, the Kakia of Kitty Cats, it's Lady B herself, Ms. Bronwyn Kelly Say.
Well, hello!
And sitting to the other metaphorical side of me is the Maya of Mimosas, the Iris of Instant Pots, the Celine of Sausage Dogs, the wonderful Lady J, Ms. Jessica Schaefer. Hello! Good day, ladies.
Doing great. How about you, Sarah?
I'm slightly losing my voice and I'm drinking peppermint tea like there's no tomorrow. So I will apologise now for the croaky inflection that I'm bringing to the podcast this month.
You always make it sound so good, though.
Yeah, I love that croak.
I'm not sure I'd go that far, but okay, I'll take that one.
And can I just say, I am forever the Boudica of Brunch. Like, I love that. Brunch is amazing. And yeah, I'm taking that. That's me forever now.
So full disclosure, we had a conversation earlier on our cheerleader chat in which I expressed the fact that I'm not 100% certain what brunch is, other than the fact it involves smashed avocado and something called a mimosa. I have now been educated as to brunch and I will be taken out to brunch in about 2 months' time and then I will know. So please feel free to send me pictures of brunch as long as it does include avocado, smashed and mimosas.
Oh, yeah. There will be many a mimosa while you're here.
Yeah. I mean, I just down
which
two
I will
of them.
Also
so.
Be smashed.
Yeah. I'm in a great mood right now after two mimosas. Feeling lovely.
I mean, there is no going wrong with mimosas. It's just delight. Just
I told you, only good things happen at brunch. It's breakfast and lunch, and you pretty much eat whatever you want and drink at the same time. So, yeah. Anyone who has a problem with brunch, you can
still
fight me.
Do you have breakfast and lunch on the same day that you have brunch, or does it kind of surpass the other two meals? I'm confused by this. Is it a hobbit thing, or?
I mean, it depends. If you're a hobbit, then obviously elevensies still comes in. But no, it usually supplants the two. You have a bigger meal, and you can include both, you know, your sweet and your savory at the same time a lot of the time. So you can, you know, you have your eggs and your bacon, but you can also have your waffle with your custard and your fruit. And, you know, so you kind of get all of the good things that are involved in the meal.
I'm sorry, waffle with custard.
Mm. Oh, what? Right. I don't, how would we describe this speaking British?
I know what custard is. It's like,
yeah, but I'm not sure you know what I'm trying to say.
No, probably not. Is your custard yellow?
Yes.
And you put that on waffles?
With fruit, yes.
Is it cold or warm?
Cold.
Oh. I cancelled my flights. I'm not coming anymore. No longer.
It's delightful and you will enjoy it.
Yeah, we don't really do custard in America, but, you know, we have custards. They're normally reserved for dessert. They're normally eaten cold. And they're made with 1,000 eggs, so I can't eat them. Actually, funny story is that someone almost killed me one day because they made like a trifle and they told me it was banana pudding. Okay. And pudding is very different than custard. Custard is made with like 17 eggs, where pudding is normally made out of a dry packet and some milk. So I'm fine with pudding. I ate like a huge serving of this and it was so delicious because it has 17 eggs in it. Okay. And I almost died. I had to go get a shot at the hospital. They had to give me, because someone almost killed me with, I was like, when I came home, I got a call from my aunt who had dinner and she's like, I'm so sorry. I didn't realize that custard, like, you know, it, like, I thought
that it was your aunt. I'm like,
she didn't she didn't mean to. She didn't mean to kill me. She told me it was pudding. She's like, oh no, it's pudding. It's pudding. I'm like, what's in here? She's like, banana pudding. And banana, if anybody knows what I'm talking about, like, banana pudding out of the package does not contain eggs. So you're fine. But banana custard is a totally different, completely different thing.
It's a very different animal. Yeah.
So I almost died by custard one day, if that makes sense.
I mean, that's not a good story.
No. For me, I find it funny because that's funny. It's like the story of my life, though. That's how I would die, though. You know what I mean? It's either custard or I always say it's going to be like death by dachshund. I'm dying by tripping over one of my dogs. That's how I die. I've already seen it. That's how it happens.
That's fair.
Yeah.
Oh, but they'll look really cute as they kill you.
Yeah, exactly. As one's staring at me right now, like, I will kill you one day.
Do they also talk in Batman voice?
They do.
Amazing. Well,
the one does. I figure the one does.
Is it Bug?
Yes, Bug is definitely the one that's talking in Batman voice.
Wow.
Anyway, now that we've totally digressed. Sorry about
Lady Castle. Now that we've, you know, predicted our own death,
you can just cut that out.
So let me read the blurb of the book. So obviously, as we always do, we'll give some kind of general impressions before we give a spoiler alert. If you haven't read Lady Castle, as I said, it is a 4-issue miniseries, so it should be fairly easy to get hold of. It is out in trade form. It came out from Boom Studios, and they are pretty good about their trades, actually, to the best of my knowledge. And it is also available on Comixology or possibly even through your local library, because my library have just updated all the comics on their app. Thank you very much. So, Lady Castle. When the king and all the men of the castle die, it's time for the women to knight up. When King Mancastle and his mighty vassals ride off on a crusade, the women left behind are not at all put out. There's a lot less armour polishing to do. Of course, when the men get themselves eaten by a dragon and leave a curse that attracts monsters to the castle, well, the women take umbrage at that. Now, Merinor, the blacksmith's wife, is king, Princess Eve is the captain, and the only remaining and least capable knight, Sir Riddick, is tasked with teaching the ladies of the castle how to fight, defend, build, and do all manner of noisy things the men had done while the women assumed they were just drunk. Novelist Delilah S. Dawson brings her first original series to the graphic novel world and is joined by breakthrough illustrator Ashley A. Woods for a rollicking fantasy adventure in Lady Castle. Obviously, I did my usual thing and checked out Goodreads. Lady Castle has got 3.61 out of 5. It's had 698 ratings and 171 reviews, which is sort of kind of average for a book like this. It didn't make, to the best of my knowledge, it didn't make a huge impression. When it was released, it was kind of a bit of a slow burner. But I will give my general impression first and just say that I really enjoyed this book, obviously, because I'm the one that nominated it for us to talk about. I thought it was funny. I thought it was sweet. I thought it went into some interesting places to do with relationships, not just between men and women, but also family relationships, relationships with power, that kind of thing. Bronwyn, what are your general impressions, please?
Well, you talk about it being a bit of a slow burn, and I have to admit it was that for me. It took a little bit for me to warm up to this one, honestly. The character and story setup felt a little abrupt to me at the beginning, though that's not entirely unexpected for such a short format. And it certainly smoothed out into a wonderfully funny and charming romp. I'd say I was fully on board before the end of the second issue and was in love by the third. So the growth rate is nigh exponential. So, yeah, I really did. By the end of that, I loved it. It did take me a little bit to get there, though.
Okay, what about you, Jess?
So I read this book when it came out. Actually, I tagged you guys this morning in my pick of the week from our comic book store, because we used to pick, you know, our books each week. And when I read the first one, I have to say, I thought it was adorable from the beginning. And I could see what you're talking about, where maybe, like, the first one didn't hook you. And it does get a lot of those reviews, too, I would like to say. Like, if you read the reviews, I think some of them are a little harsh, to be honest, for a four-part, you know, comedy. This is meant to be a comedy as well. I don't think some people got that, you know, aspect of it. It is supposed to be funny, and it's supposed to talk about, you know, these issues, but have, like, a lighthearted feel to it. So, and I think that's what it does. I think that's exactly what it is. I think it talks about, you know, these kind of feminist issues with still being funny and still being lighthearted, and maybe even easier for a much younger generation to understand. You know, I don't think every book about feminist issues should have to be very heavy and dark and serious. Like, it's a nice, you know, good-hearted romp. And as Bronwyn said, you know, it's a good romp. I like that word, by the way.
Excellent.
Yay. Yeah.
Thank you. Marvelous. Well, if anybody hasn't read Lady Castle, please do go now and pick a copy up. As I said, you know, you can get it digitally. You can probably get it in your local comic book store. You can certainly get it on online book selling retail store places, but we'd much rather you used your LCS and read it, because we are now going to go into spoiler territory. There are only four issues of the book, so we're probably going to ruin pretty much the whole thing if you haven't read it yet. That's your spoiler warning. Consider yourselves warned. Let's get into the nitty-gritty. So I wrote a lot of questions for this.
I was impressed.
Yeah, me too. I was like, geez, like, she got all of this out of four issues. I'm like,
I haven't been feeling 100% well this week, so I've been going to bed at like 8 o'clock with my comics and going, what can I come out of this one? So I am gonna mix things up a bit and not ask you these questions in the order that I gave them to you, just to really confuse you. But it makes sense to kind of start with the titles, because the title of each issue seems to be a pop culture reference, as do the back cover quotes. And I wanted to just kind of break those down a little and just see what we think of them and sort of reflect them back to the actual content themselves. So the first issue is called Welcome to Lady Castle. The second is That Pesky Werewolf Problem. The third is When Harpies Attack, and the fourth is The Black Knight Rises, which I think is the most obvious one in there that's a pop culture reference. But what you also get, and I don't know if you ladies read these in physical issues or if you read them digitally, but on the back of each floppy issue, you also then get like a weird little quote. And the first one is, listen, strange women lying in ponds distributing swords is not a great basis for a system of government, which, if you are like me and grew up in the world of Monty Python, is holy clearly...
yes, holy crap.
It's clearly a classic quote. Number two gave us, it's not easy being king, which I instantly went to the Muppets with that.
It's not easy being king.
Also, because, you know, I love the Muppets because they're awesome. The third one was Ready, Aim, Squire. And the fourth was A Knight to Dismember, which I adore just for the pun.
Yes. Right? Yeah, I'm there for that pun.
Yeah, so did you kind of... Obviously, the titles kind of refer a little bit to what's actually happening in the book. But did you kind of make the sort of same leaps that I'm making between the title of each issue and the funny little quote on the back? Or did you just take them as, this is just a funny little quote on the back? Jess, give me some thoughts on this one, please.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think each, the quote and the title, have to do with, like, what's inside the book. So, and I think it's really super clever, because you know what I mean, for each one of them, for her to find that, you know, a title and then a quote to go along with it, like, even, like, that first issue where it's, you know, I mean, the actual quote is, strange women lying in ponds distributing swords is no basis for a system of government. Like, I thought that was so amazing to change it the way she did. I then read a article where it was an interview where they had it, and she said that was like almost like the basis of how she wrote the book. So I thought that was fairly interesting as well. She was like, but what if it wasn't? Like, that was what she said, was, what if it wasn't? So I really, like, the more I read about her creation of it and then those quotes and how they like went with the book, I thought it was really genius, to be honest. I loved it.
What about you, Broman?
Yeah, I thought they were great. I loved the little tongue-in-cheek kind of flip at the end of each book. You know, it was a reference back to the story, but also kind of reinforced the lighthearted nature of these stories. Because like just said earlier in the general impressions, it's nice to have, you know, a feminist presentation that isn't sort of dark and grim and dystopian, you know?
It's you can really have a little bit of fun sometimes.
It is nice to have some fun, you know?
Feminists aren't allowed to have fun.
Oh, well, honestly, sometimes you feel that way, right?
How dare we have fun? Stop it right now.
It is, you know? It's terrible. And I mean, it's just nice to find a little bit of fun in the midst of some of the terrible things that are happening. And I think that that's a theme that you can find that kind of goes through all four of these stories, right? And the overarching story through these four issues is that there is fun to be had, and there is, you know, a little bit of lightheartedness to be had in situations that can also be dire, right? Mm. So I think that these little quotes and these little throwbacks and these little puns and things like that are just that little bit of extra at the end that reinforces that. And I thought they were very clever and I really appreciated them.
Good. And yeah, I just keep coming back to A Night to Dismember.
I really enjoyed that.
Just makes me laugh every single time because apparently I'm a child.
No. As soon as I read that, I went, come back, you yellow bastard, I'll bite your legs off.
Well, yeah, that whole, I mean, then The Black Knight Rises was clearly my favorite title. To mix, like, the Monty Python and the Batman in there was just, like, I was like, yes. And then the whole issue itself, I was like, oh, my Jesus. Like, this is fantastic. Just barely
almost
a flesh
wound. Like they wanted us to laugh at their funny book. Who knew?
Who knew?
I mean, seriously.
Stop it. We need to stop having fun right now. We have to stop. We're feminists and we need to stop having fun right now.
Serious faces, ladies. Actually, no, I'm not going to be serious. I am going to talk about something else that is amusing to me, which is the choice of the songs that they kind of parody in the various issues. And again, their relevance to the plot of each issue. And Jess, I'm especially keen to hear your thoughts on issue 4, because I know that you're not hugely familiar with Hamilton. And did you know all of the songs from all of the books, or did you not know that that entire issue 4 thing was from Hamilton?
So where I'm not overly familiar with Hamilton, I do know about it. And where I may not be that familiar with Hamilton itself, I am familiar with 90s hip-hop and rap music, especially New York-based rap music, okay? So, because that's where I grew up. And the Ten Dual Commandments is actually taken from the Notorious B.I.G. or a.k.a. Biggie, his song The Ten Crack Commandments. It's actually a nod to that song. So I did know that song. So I am pretty sure, actually, almost all the songs in Hamilton are based on classic hip-hop songs and rap songs, because Miranda wanted to pay homage to the artists that he grew up listening to. So that I do know about. So the thing for me is too, I wonder
so hard.
Yeah. Like I really love like 90s hip hop and rap music. So believe it or not, with my little gothness. Okay. That was my quiet, like listening to Biggie in my car. So yeah, I do wonder though, if when she was writing this, if she knew that that was based off a song that was actually based off Selling Crack.
I'm almost certain that she didn't, I'll be honest.
So I did find that that's what I was like, wait a second, because when I read it first, I immediately go to that song. And that was like, it was like a weird, like, I forgot even what album was on, but it was on like every mixtape. It was on everything. Like all of our friends knew it. It was like one of those things that like you just knew that song. So like I immediately go to that and I'm like, wait a second. I'm like, she can't be writing about this song in this book. I'm like, this can't be right. And then I was like, I put it together. I'm like, wait a second. They sing about, he does this in Hamilton. And that's how I figured it out. But so for me, I immediately went to the Ten Crack Commandments. And, you know, in my head, I could just hear that playing. Number 5 is never get high on your own supply. Okay. So.
Sensible.
You know.
Oh, I love that you went right there. Oh,
I'm sorry.
God.
I had to go right there. That's how, you know, I'm sorry.
You're the best.
Yeah, I did kind of have a little look into it, and whenever I've seen her talk about that, she's always referenced Hamilton. So I've kind of been laboring under the assumption that she wasn't aware of any other references that she was putting in. I might be wrong, but yes.
Okay, well, can we take a second to appreciate the Fresh Prince, though?
Yes, we can.
If anybody isn't aware, there's two songs in the first issue, one of which riffs off of When Will My Life Begin from Tangled, and one of which is the song Belle from Beauty and the Beast, which is the There Must Be More Than This Provincial Life song. In issue two, there's a song called I Wonder What the King Is Doing Tonight, which is from a show called Camelot, which is just the most obscure thing for them to have used. And then issue four is Ten Jewel Commandments, but issue three is an absolutely outstanding parody of The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. So please, Bronwyn, talk to me about The Fresh Prince.
Oh my God, I died. I laughed so hard. So like, as I said, you know, the first issue, it wasn't that it wasn't good. It just felt a little abrupt to me, you know, like it wasn't as smooth as some of the other issues. Mm-hmm. That followed it. And so, you know, we eased into two, and by two, I was like, yes, okay, no, I'm feeling this now. And then three happened, and I was like, F yes, I love this. I love this. This is so good. Oh my God. And a big part of that was The Fresh Prince. You know, I was in stitches. It was so well done. I could hear the rhythm in my head. And all of a sudden, I was like, I had to even go back and reread one and two again, because I love that such a visual medium is also presented as a musical. Mm. You know, I think that that's such an interesting technique, and it really makes this book stand out. Because, you know, you have sort of more of a traditional just written media, like with long form fiction and books and stuff like that. And then you have comics and graphic novels and things like that, where you have the sort of duality of it with the written word and the art, and they both contribute so significantly to the storytelling. And then it's almost like adding this third element to that with the musicality involved, you know. Mm-hmm. And for me, I started hearing the Fresh Prince in the back of my head as I'm reading through this, and it was just so on point with the lyrics, you know. They fit the story so well, and I was so familiar with that sound in my head, and you know, I grew up with it, and it just made me laugh, and it really fit the story she was trying to tell, and it really worked, and it just sort of made everything kind of click for me. So
awesome.
It really elevated it for me.
Unfortunately, it did also mean that I had that song from Beauty and the Beast stuck in my head for like 4 weeks.
I still do. Sorry. I apologize.
Okay, we'll just let Jess have her moment.
This is your musical interlude brought to you by Jarska.
I apologize. I really do. I apologize. I couldn't help myself.
I couldn't get the first song. I was reading it and I was like, I just can't get the tune of it. And then I showed it to Bella and she was like, oh, it's from Tangled. And as soon as she said that, I was like, oh, of course it is. And then that was stuck in there as well. So, yeah, thanks, Lady Castle, for giving me terrible, terrible earworms. That was really good of you. So if we kind of take things back to kind of the main plot of the story, they say that absence makes the heart grow fonder. I don't know who they are. They say some really weird things. Mm. But absence makes the heart grow fonder. Would either of you say that that's true for the women in Lady Castle, bearing in mind that, you know, that the song from Beauty and the Beast is about not fitting in and not having your place, but especially with sort of relation to the wives of the missing men? Bronwyn, talk to me about absence.
Honestly, I think the only application of this adage I really saw was in Princess Gwyneth, for her father, because his absence was certainly, it seemed to allow her to keep her rose-colored glasses on where he was concerned.
Yes.
You know, she seemed pretty fond of him when he was away. For the other women of Lady Castle, however, absence seemed to make the heart grow lighter more than anything, I would say. You know, they didn't appear to be fondly missing their men terribly. They seemed to be more in a waiting pattern or a holding pattern, kind of unable to move forward without them, but not happy with them either until it was kind of confirmed that they were really gone. You know, I think they were really feeling that oppression and sort of in feeling a little bit incapable of getting out from underneath it until something sort of stepped in and removed it for them, and after which they were sort of more able to move forward. And and lift that veil and kind of be free. So I don't feel like they were feeling any more fond of their men in their absence. They seemed to be kind of like a good riddance situation more than anything. You know, like Princess Gwyneth, she really seemed to miss her father. And despite the mounting evidence of the type of person that he actually was. Other than her, I didn't really see any evidence of that.
Mm. What about you, Jess?
Yeah, I'm on the same page. I think as they go on, they actually become stronger and happier through the book. And you realize, you know, they kind of move on. They get things done. They're like, all right, ladies, like, let's get our stuff together. And when they find out that, you know, that they're gone, like Bronwyn said, you can kind of clearly see them kind of move on, you know, and continue to grow on their own without these men that have kind of, you know, in this book, they really hold them back. I mean, the one princess was supposed to be a boy and the other princess is locked in a tower to, you know, preserve her purity. You know, the blacksmith's wife who becomes the king, she's you know, told to kind of be seen and not heard. You know, I know you have another question. I don't want to go too far. You know, there's women locked in the basement because they need to not be seen. So like, really, I think all these women, once these men are gone, are kind of, you know, it's the exact opposite. They're, as Bronwyn said, their hearts grow lighter. Except for, you know, Gwyneth, you know, she does, but even at the end, I don't know if she's the same way too, you know, like she kind of becomes like her own, she does her own thing, you know, she comes into her own. So
Kind of off the back of that, I want to move on to something else that I asked, which was King Mancastle and his queen, who I couldn't find a name for her. I don't know if she has a name. She's always referred to as the queen. I might have just missed her name. They are only present in the book through the memories and the opinions of Eve and Gwyneth and the other remaining inhabitants of the castle. What are your opinions of the King and Queen, or King Mancastle and the Queen, based off of what we're told by Eve and Gwyneth, bearing in mind that Gwyneth does have those rose-tinted specs on? go for it, Roman.
I put that King Mancastle sounds a bit like a wellish chauvinist pig jerk face jerk, honestly. I was going to say monster, but I think that there had to be some good in him for Gwyneth to have been so attached. And I mean, even Eve says that until she was 12 and he decided she needed to get married, that he was good to her, you know. So I think he was horribly misguided and misogynistic, and he was not a good person, but maybe not a total monster, just a garden variety asshat. So
I say what you feel. What about you, Jess? Have fun.
I think that's a great way to sum him up. You know, asshat is a good word. I like asshat. I felt the same way. I mean, I don't think you get enough context for the mother or the queen. Like, they only really talk about her very briefly. You know, when the older sister is telling the younger sister that she knew her before she passed, giving birth to Gwyneth. So you don't really get much for the queen. So, I mean, she sounded all right from what she said. She sounded like an all right lady. Like, yeah, so that's what I get. I mean, and like Bronwyn said, I think the king sounds like, you know, kind of like every, you know, every king in like every like storybook fairy tale. You know, we're doing your duty and you have to get married and blah, 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 blah. And it's like that misguided, like, this is what women do, so you have to do this kind of thing. That's my king voice, by the way.
Which is slightly British as well.
Sorry about it. I'm not sorry about it. so, you know, I mean, like, you know, he's a misguided kind of, you know, ass-headed, pig kind of, you know, that deal. I think he maybe if it was a different world and a different place, he wouldn't be, you know, it's that kind of thing. A what if, you know, maybe there could be a what if book for Lady Castle. but I agree with Bronwyn on it. He kind of just sounds like an asshat. So.
I thought it was quite interesting, Bronwyn, that you sort of use the word monster and then you backtracked on it. Because obviously a lot of the book, it is about fighting monsters. Mm-hmm. But it's also about coming to terms with the fact that King Mancastle isn't around anymore. And I think actually, sort of from my point of view, he kind of was a bit of a monster because he locked his 12-year-old daughter in a tower.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's a little bit more than RSAT behaviour for me. I'll be honest, I have opinions about locking people in towers. No, obviously, why wouldn't I? But no, I thought it was quite interesting the way that you kind of you said that, and then you went, oh, actually, but you know, he wasn't a complete monster, and I'm sure he wasn't a complete monster. But obviously, we only get to see what the other women think of him, as well as what the other women think of, you know, the other men that had lived in Mancastle, some of whom were frankly arsehats. Mm-hmm. That there's a lot of that going on. So if we kind of look at the relationship between the men and the women, instead of the classic mad woman in the attic trope, issue two gives us a genius in a basement. So can you maybe give me your thoughts not only on Yanni, who is a wheelchair bound librarian locked in a basement by her husband because he thinks that nobody will want to see her, but also the other oppressed women in the story, of which there are many. Bronwyn, do you want to go ahead on that one?
Sure. I love Yanni. She is a great character. I love that the librarian is a badass engineer. Like, that's just amazing. I loved her. She's fantastic. And I think that this book really puts a spotlight on what happens when you give women an education and an opportunity to participate in their community. And getting real for a second, there's a quote from Wikipedia, actually. It says, women's education is one of the major explanatory variables behind rates of social and economic development and has been shown to have a positive correlation with both. Like, investment in the education of women and girls is considered by a lot of the world's notable economists to be potentially the highest return available in the developing world. Like, there's actually a positive correlation between educating women and the increase in the GDP for developing countries. And I think that whether they intended it or not, this book actually sort of demonstrates that, you know, you lift this veil of oppression off these women and give them an opportunity to educate and empower themselves, and they take it and they run with it, you know, and they contribute to the community and they improve the community and they communicate with one another and they make it a prosperous place, you know. So it's making money and it's producing things and it's, you know, it's a viable, healthy economic community. So
look at Bronwyn bringing out the GDP facts today.
There you go.
That
was way more intelligent than anything I have to say.
Look, you're the one who came at us with like 25 questions, okay?
Yeah. It is your questions are, it is your fault. Well, you know, I like to start off with the fact that they didn't even know the library was there.
Yeah.
Let's bring that up. So they were like, they're like, are you sure this is the right place? And it says library across it. Like, they don't even know the library is there. So that should tell you a lot of things from the start. And then, you know, I mean, she's locked. It's not only, I think this speaks not only just about oppression of women, but also on handicap. A female and gentleman, you know what I mean? It's not just women when it comes to that, you know, and, you know, that she was going to be a burden and, you know, once she had her accident, she was shushed away and locked up and clipped, you know, behind closed doors. Mm-hmm. And, you know, unfortunately I've seen this firsthand. My mother's handicap, and she wasn't always, and now, kind of going through the struggle with her of finding places that are handicapped accessible and doing things that normal people do, or having people just kind of, you know, either people are really helpful or really, really rude, you know? So, and it's weird. And I do see that sometimes where people would just rather like shove her to the side and not have to deal with that, you know, like that's a burden. And that's what they say to her, you know, she's going to be a burden. People are not going to want to listen to what she has, you know, oh, she's going to be a problem. People are not going to want to look at her. Like, you get locked up in the basement because no one wants to deal with you. And I've watched that firsthand, you know. Even like, I love Broadway shows, my mom loves Broadway shows, but you go and try to watch a Broadway show with a handicapped person and see how much fun it is. Okay. Mm. It's not. It's terrible. It was miserable. The last time we went was horrible. You know, they wouldn't accommodate us really. They wanted us to pay. I mean, and when I say extra money, I'm not talking about a little bit of extra money. I'm talking about like an exorbitant amount of money for handicapped seating. You know, and then there's most of those theaters are old. They do not have elevators. They wanted her to climb stairs. You know, it was like, it was insane.
Somewhat
it was
missing the point.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's kind of illegal though. Like, don't you actually have to have?
It's somewhat, but they get around it by, you know, a lot of these buildings that these theaters are in are historical. Oh, you know, yeah. They've been, so they get around it from that. But I mean, the charging of extra money. So yeah, so, you know, when I read this portion of her being locked in a basement because she was a woman and because she was handicapped, like, you know, it really spoke to me. I was like, wow, like this still happens today. This is really happening. You know, this really happens to people. So, yeah. I felt that was, you know, I think her husband is the monster. You know, I think that's the monster. I think he's even more of a monster than the king was. At least the king gave her somewhere to go, you know?
Mm. Yeah.
So, yeah.
And I think that's important as well, is that, as you said about the fact that they didn't actually know the library was there and that she's been there all that time. The fact that she is so intelligent and so well-read and so educated just kind of goes to prove that her husband thought, oh, I can just shut her away and she'll be forgotten about. And mm-hmm. and in a way, she was forgotten about. But she didn't just waste that time by sitting around moping. She got on and she did stuff and she educated herself and she read all those books. And I think that's actually one of my favourite things about Yanni is mm-hmm. that as soon as they come in asking these random questions, what do you know about werewolves? There's no woe is me. There's no I feel so terrible. I've been here all this time. She's just straight out of business. She's, you know, she doesn't mess about. She's like, right, here's what you need to know. And then they just get on with it. Same as with the other female characters who have clearly suffered somewhat at the hands of their husbands, whether it be because they have to wear a mask because nobody wants to look at them or because they've been literally locked away. Mm-hmm. I think there is a lot in there to do with how we treat people who are different from us and how we treat mm-hmm. quote unquote the other, which it spoke to me quite a lot personally. And it's one of the things about this book is the first time I read it, I kind of thought, oh yeah, Lady Cast, it was just like a sweet little story about, you know, princesses doing it for themselves. And then when I go back and read it, I think actually there's a lot more in here. Yeah. There is a lot more in here.
A lot to unpack. Yeah.
And kind of sticking with this idea of the other, when Lady Castle was first published, especially after she won, it received a fair amount of online criticism that the book wasn't doing enough for the representation of minorities or for POC or BAME characters. Do you think that justification or that criticism was justified? Or do you think that was just kind of people jumping after the first issue and not waiting to see what the whole finished product was?
Yeah. I just think people didn't read the whole book and they read the first issue and were like, there's not enough of this in here. And honestly, I really hate that too. You know what I mean? Like, I think there should be representation of everybody, but like, you know, I don't need it to be like really forced. You know, I think in this book, there's a natural progression of it. And there is, it's not, you know, they act like, I know a lot of people were upset. I read a lot of comments like, how can none of these women be lesbians? And I thought to myself, I'm like, she doesn't talk about sexuality in this book really at all. No. So why would we? How do we know? We don't know. They could totally be lesbians. No one knows. OK, because she doesn't talk about sexuality. Why? I don't understand why, you know, in this, and I don't think it's needed in this book. You know what I mean? Like, I just don't think it needs to be there. It's a 4-issue miniseries. I think it has women of color. It has, you know, young, old, you know, we find out that the plague doctor is a young Indian woman wearing a hijab. You know, it there was plenty. And I think people just really jumped down it like way too soon. Way too soon.
So. Yeah. What about you, Borman?
Yeah. I mean, okay, so sometimes I feel a little uncomfortable answering questions like this because as a white woman, it's not 100% my place to say if there's appropriate representation because I always see myself, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it's not really my place to say, you know, is so-and-so seeing enough of themselves here? I don't know. It's not my place to say that, you know? There definitely were you know, other races represented. If you read through to the end there, you know, it's not an all white cast. You know, there is obviously, like, the sisters are white. It's not like one, you know, I mean,
yeah, but
could they have made it differently? Yeah, but that would have been a little bit different. This is a short form story. Like, it's only four issues. So it's tough to cram all of that in there. Are you going to get every, you know, representation of every type of person out there into a four issue story? No. I don't think that there's a way to do that and do it well. Mm. Was there appropriate representation for everyone? I don't know. I don't know if I can answer that. Do I appreciate that there was a multicultural cast? For me, from my perspective, I do. Is my perspective the one that people want to hear? I don't know.
Mm. Yeah, I agree with you. No.
Yeah, and I think that's important, because quite often when people kind of make comments like that, or I find that when people make comments like that, it is almost kind of a pile on, you know, and people go, oh, one person has noticed that this one book hasn't done something. And if a book is coming across as being a feminist title, quite often it's almost like that book has to be everything for everyone.
Yeah.
Because, you know, well, you said that you were feminist, so you have to represent everybody. And for me, again, speaking as a white woman who lives on the south coast of England, which is frankly like the whitest place ever, I look at this book and I think there is a decent amount of representation here. But if I wasn't a white woman from the south coast of England, maybe I wouldn't think that. But I did sort of feel that some of the criticism that was pushed towards the book was maybe a little bit early. And I don't know if that made a difference to the characters moving forward. I don't know if the whole thing was written and drawn before the first issue came out. So, you know, maybe they did take that criticism on board. I don't know. Speaking about the artist changing, the artist on the first issue actually changed before issue two. So Ashley A. Woods did all of the art and the colour for the first issue. And then for issues 2, 3, and 4, Becca Farrow did the art and Rebecca Nalty did the colours. Did you find that affected your enjoyment of the story at all? Or did you find that Marinor and Eve and Gwyneth looked or were represented differently after issue two? Jess, I'm going to go to you as our resident artist. Or were you like me and did you completely not notice any difference until you went to write down the names of all the creators?
I can notice a slight difference, but I think the two styles are so almost identically similar. And I think, the second artist, she definitely tried to keep the same format and look, and the colors are still very similar. For me, it really didn't have any effect because I think it was kept so very similar and so well done too. That's the other thing. This was not like one artist was phenomenal and then they went to like an artist that was subpar. It's not that. Both women were fantastic. So, you know what I mean? I've unfortunately seen that in other books that I love. I don't want to mention too many names, but there's a book specifically that I loved that had an artist and then had another artist that was great and then had another artist that didn't quite work with it, you know, and didn't work with the book. And then they fired
her. And
now
you have to tell us the name of the book.
Oh, you know what name of this book is. And I feel bad for it, but it's Rat Queens, okay? And love, and like, Flower's work is lovely, but it didn't match that book at all. It just didn't go with it. And, you know, the other guy was an asshat. We'll call him a monster. Cedric's work was beautiful on it, but he couldn't stay on the book, you know? And I think, you know, that's the thing. So it really, when you read through that book, it takes you out of it. You know, that's the difference. And it's like I said, again, I don't want to say her art was not subpar or bad. It was still beautiful. It did not match the tone of that book at all. And what they did how they fired her was like the worst thing I've ever seen in my life. That is like what not to do in public relations and marketing. Like that should be in a textbook of what not to do and how not to handle things. So, if you want to go look at that yourself, that's a whole other podcast.
note to self.
Yeah, that's a whole other podcast. It was really bad and I really feel bad for her. But like I had to agree that her art just didn't match the book where she is so talented and she does such beautiful work. It just didn't match where this I did not think was the same thing. I thought like you can, like you said, Sarah, you had no idea where if you read through Rat Queens, you would know right away. You would be like, oh, this is not the same. You know, so I think they did it in a very tasteful way. I'm not sure. I tried to do a little reading. I didn't see what happened or why it changed. I don't know if you saw something about why.
I couldn't find any reason why why there was the change at all. Yeah. I don't know if it was pre-planned. There was nothing.
Yeah. No, so I really didn't think it affected it. I thought it was still, I think both artists really did a great job. And I think the second artist really did a great job with trying to keep in the same style and colors and stuff of that nature.
What about you, Bronwyn? Were you completely oblivious to it like I was, or are you a better person than I am?
I would never say that I'm a better person by any stretch of the imagination, but I very much noticed. I don't know why I noticed. Maybe something about the faces. But I'm with Jess. I thought both art styles were incredible. I thought they were very similar. But there was something about the faces, especially Eve's face in the second art style. And I actually preferred it. I preferred it in the second artist. Now, that said, as I said, this is in no way to disparage the first artist, because I thought they were both gorgeous and very similar. But there was something about the way she was drawn by the second artist that made her look almost masculine sometimes. But in a really interesting and beautiful way. I think that was really perfect for her character and the way her character was being developed in that story, you know, with her sort of cutting her hair and coming out of the tower and doing that whole thing and just changing it. But it was more than just, you know, her cutting off her dress and dressing more like a knight and putting on her armor and everything like that. There was something specific about the way her face changed in that second story. And I noticed the change in the art, but I didn't specifically know it was a different artist until I finished that second issue.
Yeah.
Cause like I'm like, wow, she looks so completely different that I actually went and checked. So I don't know what it was that caught my eye that made her that I can't identify the specific feature or specific thing, but there was something about Eve that I was just like, oh, what is happening here? I like it. And I went and checked. I'm like, oh, that's a different artist. Okay.
And I'm just sitting here oblivious. La 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 la.
I definitely see it in the face. Her face is more defined, I think, is what it is. You know, the second artist draws her with a little bit more of a jawline. And that's what I think it probably, that's where you're getting like the masculinity from, you know, because she's got more of like this strong jawline. But again, like you said, she does cut off her hair. She does dress a little bit more masculine. So like, you know, you could almost think that it was a different, that she went for a different face on purpose. You know what I mean? Yeah. That she changed her face on purpose. But but they're pretty similar. But
it's subtle. It's very subtle. And but as I said, I really like it. I think it suits her and suits the story.
Yeah. I will say, like, I think the second artist is a little bit more graphic. Does that, you guys know what I'm talking about? A little bit more darker black lines, a little bit more pronounced line work. And that's what changes it quite a bit.
Yes. Yeah absolutely.
Sticking with the art, let's talk about the choice of the color palettes in the book, because each of the issues for me had a specific page or a specific section that just really popped out with the color. So for example, in the first issue, the page where the they think they're being attacked by dragons and Eve says, you know, time to knight up, and it turns out it's actually salamanders.
I love that.
Which is amazing. So that specific page really stood out in that issue. And then in issue two, it was the section where the sky is purple. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're kind of getting on the horses. Issue three, it was the pinks when they go and see Felicia and the ladies. And then in issue four, it was the page where the Black Knight has got Gwyneth in the cage, and it's kind of all the woodland backgrounds, and then you just get a couple of panels that are just orange backgrounds. And for like that color for me really, really stood out. And Bronwyn, I know that you have very strong opinions about color, and you respond to color very well.
Yes.
How did you feel about the choice of the color palettes throughout Lady Castle?
I freaking loved it. The color is so yes, nailed it. And I read this digitally. And one of the things that I love about reading digitally, and it's funny because there's very much a difference. And we have a very large collection of like trades and hardbacks and things like that. And we actually rebuy comics all the time to try and get our collection into like the bigger collected works of in physical books, because it's nice to have physical books too, and especially when they're in beautiful presentations and things like that. And I love that. But I actually really enjoy reading digitally as well, because there's one thing that Comixology does when it's when you get this presentation, and it's like when I do it on my iPad, I can actually see a layout where you can see a small sort of thumbnail of a lot of pages all at the same time. Mm. And so you can get an overall view of the color palette.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really interesting. And you can kind of sort of see the theme of the whole issue or the whole arc, you know? And it, I just love that. You can see sort of the flow of the color through. And so even kind of more so than just page to page or issue to issue, you can see the flow through the whole kind of story.
Yeah.
And I love that because it kind of goes from this like pale pink purple into this darker bluey purple, right up into that rose where you're talking about where the ladies are, you know, where you meet Felicia and thing, and then ends on this with this really robust, it's got this sky blue and then these teal greens for the forest. And then, as you say, that orange, and it's, they're all really saturated color, and it's, I don't know. It's so, it adds the sense of satisfaction, and I don't know why I respond so well to, or so deeply to these specific colors, but they're very, that sense, those colors at the end, they're very, I don't know. They say conclusion. You know, that's, it's, they're more saturated than the colors in the previous three issues.
Mm. Jess, talk to me about color. I just have to say before actually you do that, I love how enthused Bronwyn gets about colour, and it's just like my favourite thing is listening to you talking about the colour you use in books, because obviously I can only look at these page to page because I read them in paper form, and just hearing you talk about it is just lovely. Anyway, Jess.
So I actually have these both. I have single issues, and if you have Comixology Unlimited, you can actually rent and just borrow this book right now. For free. So I, to like do all the rereads, like I found my single issues, but I just popped it up on, cause I have an iPad Pro that I read it on. And let me tell you about like what gorgeousness happens when you pop up a Comixology comic book on an iPad Pro. It's beautiful. The screen on that thing is lovely. And, you know, it makes everything just like kind of like glow. You can have the darkest book in the world and it's still like vibrant, you know? Mm-hmm. So for me, I think about it in more of like a design. And like you said, Bronwyn, you can see like kind of the progression of colors go through each issue, and even kind of like every couple of pages, to be honest with you. It's not even each issue. She'll have a section where it's like there's a lot of green, a lot of purple. I mean, obviously, sometimes it's nighttime, sometimes it's daytime. You're going to get that. But to me, what that reminds me of is like Disney, you know, Disney princesses, to be honest, like, you know, like a Disney movie. And that's what they do with those movies. And you'll notice that like a lot of fairy tale stuff like that will use color like that, where like it will be dark and dreary, and then at the end it's this beautiful burst of light, you know, and it's to signal in our brains that this is happiness, and like you said, that this is the end, and that this is concluding, and that this is, you know, everyone's happy ever after. Different colors, you know, they say different colors make your brain spark different ideas or different feelings. Okay, I think we talked about this before too, where like certain companies use certain colors.
Red and yellow make you hungry.
Yes, red and yellow make you hungry.
I remember like, that ever since.
Yeah. So, you know, so I think it's also the colorist on this was very clever because he does use that, and you can definitely tell that. And like there's like one page where Gwyneth and the King, I like to call her the King. I just like to call her the King. Sorry. are talking to each other, and they get on their horses to go fight. And you could see the background shift from this, like it's supposed to be the sun rising, but you can see this pop of orange at the bottom that kind of lets you know that they're going, you know what I mean? That they're going into this and they're coming, you know, they're coming out of the dark and into the light. So yeah, I thought the use of color in this book was fantastic. It definitely has that Disney fairy tale, you know, vibe to it, which they definitely were going for. And she talks, like I said, I've read a couple interviews with her where she talks about that's where they were going for. She sings her song to the tune of Beauty and the Beast, you know. So I think it really, the use of color in this book was absolutely brilliant. I thought it was great.
Awesome.
Well, I love that I felt that without knowing any of that stuff.
Yeah. Well, that was like,
clearly it was.
Color theory 1, 2, 3, and 4. So, you know, that was like 4 years of college for me, but you know.
Apparently I'm the target audience.
Yeah, you are. You are definitely the target audience. 100%.
I love it when a plan comes together. Going back to a character that we name checked there, I just want to talk a little bit about Felicia, because Felicia is a very interesting character to me, given the difference between how Eve expects her to be and how she thinks of herself. So Felicia is wearing the classic Disney princess gown. You know, she has got the beautiful pink dress and she's got the flowing blonde hair, and she clearly is, out of all of the characters we see, she is the stereotype of this is what the princess looks like. But what are you ladies' thoughts on the role that she's given and her response to the part that she has to play with the harpies, as to kind of, you know, it's sort of thrust upon her. Bronwyn, talk to me about Felicia, please.
Felicia is actually one of my favorite characters. I thought she was brilliantly done. I thought her addition to the story was actually just a stroke of brilliance. It could have been so easy to leave her out entirely, you know, or not make her as complex as she is. But by adding her and just having that relationship with Eve and having the sort of the realization by Eve that Felicia was just as trapped as she was, you know, and that having her that change Eve's outlook a little bit and have like just having that implication of that change in their communication and in their relationship through having to work together to host the harpies.
Mm.
You know, it's subtle. It's not a huge conversation piece, but it for me was really impactful. It was actually a really sort of important moment in the story. Was, you know, Eve comes into this interaction in a really kind of confrontational way.
Yes.
And then by the end of it, it's almost like they're really super close, you know.
Mm.
There's been a whole 180 in terms of her interaction with Felicia and her approach to Felicia and I think her way of even looking at Felicia, and to see that kind of development in a character who's already been through so much.
Yeah.
And to see that development occur in such a short span, I thought that was very, very well done.
Mm.
And I thought Felicia was so graceful, but without being like, yeah, you say she's a very stereotypical presentation in terms of like her physical nature. She absolutely is. What she isn't is the stereotypical presentation of a princess in her personality.
No.
You know, when Eve comes in and confronts her, she doesn't respond defensively. She responds quietly and with the, you know, like, this was not my choice.
Yeah.
I'm here in the same way you're here, and I want to help in whatever way I can. And she seems to approach her responsibility in the harpy hosting duties just with the idea that she's happy to have her skill set be something that can actually be used. You know, she doesn't feel like she can come in and be a knight, and she doesn't feel like she can come in and be an engineer, and she doesn't, you know, she isn't one of the badass ladies, you know, like Yanni and Marinor and even Eve herself, you know. She didn't take her prison and turn it into a training ground.
No.
You know, so maybe she's feeling a little less than some of the others, but she's not letting that show. And she's got this quiet strength and she wants to be useful. And she's taking all of what she knows and she's being as useful as possible. And I respect the hell out of that. I think this is a really cool and interesting and complex character to be developed in such a short period of time.
Yes. Yeah, because she does, you find it so much about her just sort of in four pages.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that when she's talking to Riddick, she says, never send a man to do a woman's job. And then we get the Fight Club moment. Yeah. Welcome to tea time. The first rule of tea time is you do not talk with your mouth full. The second rule of tea time is you do not talk with your mouth full. And I thought that it was so cleverly done.
Yeah.
The third rule of tea time, kill them with kindness. If you show anger, they win. That is such a strong statement, especially when 2 pages before you've seen her talking to Gwyneth and Eve and saying, consider your own history. King Mancastle wasn't one for asking permission. I just think she's such a powerful character to just, you know, we're 3 issues in at this point, and I sort of know where we're going with the story. And then you just throw Felicia in there.
Yeah.
And she just adds something so much extra to the mix. Yeah. Jess, what do you think of Felicia?
Yeah, no, I'm on the same page. And I would like to also point out that she is wearing, like, the fur coat as well at that point where she's doing Fight Club thing. And I was, like, I was, like, crying. I couldn't even handle it. I was like, this is the best thing I've ever seen. The fact that she's wearing, like, an open, you know, like, the open fur coat. I'm like, this is just magical. But, you know, I think it goes back to what we were talking about before, where... You know, she may not be a fighter, but, you know, she's still a strong woman. And I think there's a lot of this going on right now. You're talking about gatekeeping before we got on the show, you know, and you know, like, I don't think that we should be told how to be a woman, you know, like she's a different kind of woman. She's not the same as the other ladies, but she has her strengths. Those are her strengths. And she uses her strengths to her best ability. She knows who she is clearly in this book. Like she, you know, she didn't want to be locked up in a room, but she's beautiful and pretty. And that's what she is. You know, I feel bad. I see a lot of, you know, I don't think you should be like, you know, showing your hoo-ha on Instagram, but like I see a lot of girls that get a lot of hate for being naturally beautiful, you know, that they're just hated on. Oh, you're just pretty. And I think, you know, that's the kind of thing that they touch on here. Like, no, she's not just pretty. She knows what she has to do. And, you know, and she uses everything that she has, you know, in her toolkit to do what she needs to do, you know? And she wound up, you know, really helping them. And you know, instead of having some crazy time, they sit down with the Harpies and have tea time and have, you know, all that type of stuff. And it's because of
her.
And
those tools are no less worthy.
Exactly. And you know, we see Gwyneth kind of like looking at her like, like, who are you, pretty lady? Like, you know, you can't be, you know. But that's the thing, you know, and I don't think that, you know, I think they really touch really well on that without kind of like, you know, throwing it in your face. And I know this book got a lot of criticism because people said that it was too, you know, like on the nose, like in your face-ish with some of the stuff. But I think that if you really read this book, it's not, you know, because that's there. And I don't think people picked up on that at all sometimes, you know, in some of these reviews that I've read, you know, stuff like this and, you know, the way she uses her skill set. I think it's great. I thought that she was a wonderful character.
So, Jess, following off the back of what you said there, do you feel that the feminist overtones of the book sometimes overpower the story, which was quite a common criticism of Lady Castle? Or for you, is there a good balance between the, you know, the portrayal of feminism and story and character development?
You know, I think it's, you know, I don't think it does. And again, I think people missed the fact that this book was supposed to be a comedy as well. And that was supposed to, I feel like that was meant to be there. You know what I mean? I don't think the book would have been as funny if she didn't, like, you know, beat you over the head with it a little bit. It's used as a little bit of comedy. It's supposed to be there. I think it aids the story. It keeps it moving along. And I, you know, I think it goes well with the type of story that it is. If it was something different, maybe not. Maybe it would be too much. But again, like comedy, ha, huh, laugh, people, have a little fun. Like, it's a little bit of fun. Like, it's not gonna kill us to have fun, I feel, you know.
Welcome to satire.
Yeah, exactly. Like, have you never read a piece of satire? Like, sometimes I feel that, though. Like, no one's ever read a little bit of satire. Like, it's supposed to be there. They're supposed to be clear tropes. They're supposed to be there.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry, rant over. I'm gonna stop ranting.
Roman, do you want to turn it ranting?
Yeah, okay. I like it. I think Jess said it as perfectly as it could be said, to be honest. I said, no, I Yeah, not to, I don't believe that they overpower the story, not to a degree that makes it less enjoyable, because as just ranted perfectly, they're supposed to be there. Like, this is part of how the story is created, right? You know, it's a strongly feminist book, absolutely. And I don't find them to be overtones. I find them to be part of the story creation process. You know, like, they can't be removed without changing the story irreparably. So in that way, I feel it's totally balanced.
Hmm.
I wouldn't necessarily recommend the book for somebody who doesn't have a feminist perspective.
definitely not. Definitely not.
They might definitely not get it.
You know, they may not appreciate it the same way that I do. but no, I don't feel like they are out of balance in any way, shape, or form, because as Jess so appropriately said, it's a tool. They're being used as a tool to increase the level of humor in something that is satirical. So mm-hmm. I think that is perfectly balanced.
Awesome. And kind of sticking with the fact that this is satire and it is supposed to be humorous, and that it does make quite good use of some classic tropes, I want to talk a little bit about Sir Riddick. He obviously is the appropriate response. He's obviously designed to fill the role of the clown, the buffoon, the jester. And he's also our one fully fleshed out named male character that we actually get to see some interactions with. So I just kind of want to talk a little bit about how he's used to represent men in general, the men of the era under King Mancastle, and how his attitude kind of differs from that of the various women. And I'm actually just going to kind of start a little bit on this one, in that when I was reading the book at first, I really didn't like Riddick. Like, I understand he is there in that role of buffoon, but at the same time, I was just like, you're taking the parody a bit far, because he's a buffoon, but he's also an idiot. And it wasn't until sort of later issues that actually his intelligence kind of came out a bit. And really, for me, one of his major turning points was the scenes with Felicia, when he literally stands to one side and points to a lady and says, "This is not my area of expertise." And I found that quite interesting, that they take the character, because, you know, classically the jester is there to make a valid point and is there to kind of prove this point. And when he starts off, he's like, you know, "What ho, ladies, don't worry, I'm here to save the day." Huzzah! And he actually kind of realizes, I'm just going to use that voice forever now for everything. I shall consistently speak like this.
Yes, please.
Thing I ever do. No, I won't, because that actually quite hurts.
Oh, no.
So he says, sort of, you know, in the first issue, "Listen up, ladies. Chivalrous conduct means bravery, courtesy, honour and gallantry towards yourselves. And he just doesn't get it. He doesn't understand at that point. But as his character develops, we kind of see the fact that actually maybe, you know, maybe he can learn and maybe he's not completely useless. So now that I've finished doing my Sir Riddick voice, which apparently amuses Jess, so
I'm sorry. It really does. It kills me. I'll use my king voice.
I shall
use my royal voices.
Of course you do. The sort of the posh princess voice, if that hurts. It's slightly more breathy and a little bit more, you know,
a little
feminine.
I'm here. So I'm glad that you also, like, I don't know if you guys do this, but I read these in voices like that, because I don't know if you do this, but I am totally doing this voice in my own head. What were we talking about? Riddick. I actually almost, I feel like kind of bad for him in a way. Like, I felt bad. Like, you know, here was this man, he's a manly man, and he's going to come to be chivalrous and save the day. And he really doesn't, you know, and he is the jester. And I mean, again, this is one of those things where it was like, on, you know, way over, you know, done. It wasn't subtle at all. This was beat you over the head with it, like with a big giant bat type, stereotyping like this mm-hmm. type of guy. But, you know, unfortunately, I've met this type of guy, you know, I've met this person and we have met this person, but I think it's important. Yeah. But I think what's important though, that they do, and as you mentioned that they do,
You said doo-doo.
I said doo-doo.
I'm not editing that out.
Oh, I know you're not. Is that he does change. He does learn, you know, and that's the important part to take out of this. So where he is the jester or the buffoon or you know, this, you know, we're going to fight. I will save you, ladies. Like, you know, none of you are fighters. You can't be fighters. You're ladies. You know, at the end, like you said, like where he starts to realize like, oh, maybe these ladies do have something that I don't have. So, and that's what I think is most important about his character is that he actually grows and that people can change or that, you know, people's opinions and how they perceive things can change if they are educated. So I think that's a really important part of his character. But yeah,
people can get better even when they start off as an idiot.
Some people can't. I mean, I'm not saying all people can. I've clearly met people that will never change. But, you know, he does.
There is a difference between can and will.
Yes.
Sadly so.
Alas.
Bronwyn, what did you think of Riddick? And would you also like to grace us with your Sir Riddick voice? Because we've both done it, so you have to.
Oh, no. Oh, God, I don't know if I can do a Sir Riddick voice the same way you guys can. The one in my head is never going to come out of my voice.
It's okay. We're not going to force you. We're all friends here.
Oh, God. I'll see if I can work up to it.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, I had obviously much the same impression of him with the parody of chivalry. I also focused a little bit on his cowardice. Because at the end of the day, you know, not only is he an idiot, he's also cowardly, like in the worst way.
Hiding in a well. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And while he does make a wonderful change, you know, I think one of my favorite panels is on page 63 where, you know, he kneels down and he actually, you know, touches on the lesson that he's learned. And he says, and he apologizes and he says that he's learned that when he has always been fighting and he thought that fighting for the women was what he needed to do because that's what chivalry meant. But now he realizes that that just made them a prize.
Yep.
And that moment there for me, that was one of my favorite panels for Riddick because he finally had figured it out. Like he's gone from not even seeing the women. You're not even seeing that they're there. You know, he knows that there are things around him, but he's not seeing them as people.
They're pretty and they smell nice.
Exactly. You know, and, you know, at first it took fear. You know, it took Marinor actually scaring him into treating them with respect to actually looking around and seeing that they're being very effective. In fact, more effective than him and more effective than any of the men had been before him, you know. And then when he started noticing, he started looking around, he started seeing this, he started respecting it a bit more. And then he was willingly following the king and quite loyally so, and actually admonishing anyone who didn't immediately follow his example, which I actually enjoyed. You know, but it is that moment, as you say, with Felicia and the ladies and the prep for the harpy hosting, where he really starts to turn that corner and actually learn, you know, that his previous behavior and kind of everything that his life has been based on is really not right. Mm-hmm. And that he needs to start rethinking. But through all of this whole arc, he is still the cowardly lion.
Oh, he really is. He really is.
And that never really changes. So that, I think, is the biggest attitude difference between him and the ladies, is that he is always going to run and hide.
I love,
and they are going to face it.
I loved when he goes to hide in the well, but the woman, I forgot her name, the woman that's in the well, like, hits him out. Hagatha. And Hagatha, I love that she's, like, the guy on the couch. You know what I mean? Like, that she just, like, pops up and, like, has things. Like, oh, Hagatha has this. Or, like, Hagatha popped out of the well. And, like, you know, and Hagatha wouldn't let Riddick stay in the well. I was, like, crying. I was, like,
oh, so good. Yeah. You know, and other than that, other than his cowardice, the only thing that really I thought separated him from the ladies, and this again may change a little bit, but was that his tendency did tend to be more violence first, ask questions later.
Fight.
Yes. Which we're gonna was fight. The problem and that got all the men with. Killed in the first place, right?
Yes.
So
yes.
Yes, there was not a lot of learning from his mistakes in that first issue, it has to be said.
Not so much,
It did take him a while for that little bit of character development to kick in.
We're just going to fight things. Rah! Like that.
Rah! Yeah, exactly. Just fight all the dragons.
Yeah, we'll fight all the things. I'm just going to punch it in the face and it'll be good. Rah! Anyway.
I will kill it. I will kill it for chivalry.
So kind of sticking with the themes of chivalry and, you know, killing things dead and the cowardly lion, out of all of the different threats that the castle faces, which ones are your favourite and which of the resolutions or the decidedly non-violent responses to the threats did you enjoy the most? Bronwyn, you gave us the phrase cowardly lion, so do you want to lead on this one?
Okay. Honestly, I have to admit that the salamanders were my favorite. They're so cute. Oh my god, I love the salamanders.
I want one. I love that she keeps it and puts it in her like kiln. That's where it stays. So like, and he just heats. And then like you could see it in other things where he's just like laying in there like snuggled up. I'm like,
oh. I love that the whole castle is now teeming with salamanders. They're part of the community. Like they're just lighting the walls and powering the forge. And everything is all salamander. It's forced salamander. It just makes me so happy. Like, they're so cute and their little faces. Oh my god. Oh my god. Salamander.
That was basically the response I was expecting from Jess.
Yeah, that's the response that you're going to get as well. Salamanders.
They're like tiny dragons.
They are like, I'm with her. Like, I loved it. They just put them in vases. Like, they were just like, oh, we'll put them in a vase and stick them over here. We put them in things and they just kind of like had them all around. And like I said, she was just in her little kiln or whatever that is, like the forge. And it was just like laying in the forge. You're like all curled up in a little ball, like a little puppy.
Like a little ping
pong. I can't. I love it. I did also love the werewolf. So when they wake up and they're all a bunch of naked dudes, like
show some respect for your king.
Wander out with their frocks on.
They're all just like covering their junk. Like let's be honest,
that is the best. That is absolutely the best solution. Is that they have to pee all the way around the castle.
Yes.
I thought that was hilarious. You know, and just how they get them up in the tower, she's like taking off her clothes, she's like, look, there's some damsel flesh over here for you boys, you know,
like,
yeah, exactly, like I just loved it. She's like, hold on, I got the solution. And I find it funny that that's what they're attracted to, you know, like show a little skin and they're running chasing her up the tower, like, and that's the thing, like that, where that is very, where I don't think that's hit you over the head, that was pretty subtle of like, you know, a commentary on, you know, oh, show a little skin and they're following you through the yard.
You know? I may have noticed that one. I'll be honest, I absolutely love the harpies. With their we're coming to your house for tea. That's it.
And then we're going to pillage.
Pillaging is scheduled for free. Yeah.
And then we're going to pillage. So
that's
going to happen.
It was very British. It was, very British.
PSVP.
Yeah.
Yes. Prepare yourselves. Genius. The please is a formality. I love the please prepare yourself. But yeah, I thought they were absolutely great, and they've basically come along and said, look, you know, we don't have any choice about this. We live on a rocky outcrop. You've got stuff. We want the stuff. We're just going to take it. And then Merinor Merinor's like, squishy, I'll squish your, yep. But it's Felicia who's like, actually, let's think about this for a minute. Let's take a look at what we can do. And then even Gwyneth kind of gets in on the action.
Yeah.
Even Gwyneth gets in on the action. And she's like, we'll teach you how to do stuff and you can trade stuff with us. And, you know, let's all be better people for it. And then the harpy is like, oh, let's consider this over a cup of tea in a very civilized fashion.
I know. I love that.
So, yeah, I think actually the harpies, adorable as the salamanders are, Not taking anything away from the salamanders.
Oh my god.
But I do love the harpies. They do make me laugh a lot.
They actually reminded me of you. I'm like, this is how Sarah would attack people. She'd send them a lovely letter that says, like, please, I'm coming to get you. Thank you very much. I would say sorry at the bottom for something, and that would be it.
And there would be tea and cake.
And there would be tea and cake. Yeah, exactly. Oh God, there would be some kind of baked good. That's what I really did. It made me think, Sarah.
That's amazing. That's possibly the nicest thing anyone's ever said to me. Bearing in mind that I am sitting here recording with my teapot and my cup and saucer, drinking my peppermint infusion as we record.
Not be more British than you are right now.
I could have crumpets. If I had crumpets, I'd be peak British right now. And now I really wish that I had crumpets.
I really kind of want crumpets too. I've never had a crumpet, but they sound delicious.
Right?
You've never had a crumpet?
No, I'm painfully American. We've talked about this.
But you've never had the joy of going out for a long walk on a Sunday and coming home and having toasted crumpets. Absolutely.
I'm not exactly sure what a crumpet is. I've just like kind of seen pictures. I think, you know, is that the one that you put the cream on? No, those are different.
No, that's a scone.
Oh, that's a scone. Those, I have had a scone. Scones are also delicious.
No, a crumpet is a kind of spongy, slightly savory, circular. It's almost like a bread with lots of holes in it, and
it's
just kind of
smother it. It's kind of like an English muffin.
I'm down for that. I'm good for that. I'll have one of those.
Basically just going to fly to America with a suitcase full of food, aren't
please,
I?
Please, please, please and thank you.
Yeah.
Just feed me. That's all I need. Okay.
Just no eggs.
No eggs.
Getting things back on track, because we may have just taken a mild diversion into team.
We all left at Albuquerque.
Let us talk about favourite characters, because I have got a favourite character in Lady Castle, and that is Felicia, because she just steals it for me. It was going to be Gwyneth. Like, I love Gwyneth, but when I reread her, she does get a little bit whiny at times.
So whiny.
Although I should actually apologise to Bella at this point, because when I was rereading it the other week, I was like, oh my God, you're so Gwyneth. You just are. Like, with the whole tomboy thing, and my response to everything is to just threaten to stab it in the face. I should point out she's playing a lot of Assassin's Creed Origins. She doesn't literally stab people in the face. It's only ancient Greeks that get that treatment. But yeah, like I adore Gwyneth, and I think that she's superb. But at times, the woe is me, I'm such a poor little orphaned princess, everything is terrible, does just get a little bit grating. So I think Felicia kind of edged it out a bit for her. What about you, Bronwyn? Do you have a favourite character? Can you choose a darling for me?
It's tough. I was going with Yanni because I really, really, really like the badass librarian. Mm. But I think I might actually have to go with Marinor.
I know. Talk to me about Marinor. Bearing in mind that, you know, Marinor is the king, we have actually said very little about her so far. So
yes.
Tell us why we should be team Marinor.
Okay, well, because she's awesome. She jumped right in to being a king. She was the blacksmith's wife. She was oppressed by somebody who told her she was worth nothing. Hmm. And then with no training and no warning and no expectation, she picked up a sword to admire it because this is what she has done her whole life. And that automatically conferred kingship onto her. And now she's responsible for a whole community worth of people. And she ran with it and she nailed it. And now all of a sudden the entire weight of this whole thing is on her shoulders, and you can see that, and she's vulnerable, and she has these emotions, and she knows, and she's afraid, and she's still running with it, you know, and she asks for help, and she surrounds herself with talented people, and she is doing all of the right things and leading with strength, but also wisdom and community. And I just, To take on that level of responsibility with no sort of previous inkling that it was coming for you, that's huge. And she does it. And okay, and can we talk about those arms? Because those are goals.
Yeah. Yeah.
100%.
I'm looking at my arms right now, and no, they do not look the same.
I mean, I'm working on it, but damn, girl.
Yeah. I'd point out none of us are blacksmiths, so we have a bit of an excuse.
Yeah.
Maybe not the best one, but...
But no, I think, like, quietly, King Marinor, she's a kick-ass character.
That is true. That is very, very true. There is no denying that. Jess, what about you? Who's your favorite?
I have to agree 100% with B, because that's what I wrote down as well. Marinor is my favorite character. That scene of her sitting behind the door, where she is just like, I don't know what I'm doing. Like, how do I not, you know, like, you know, I could connect a lot with that. Like, I've especially recently been thrown into many situations where I've had to, like, lead things and I'm like, I have no clue what I'm doing. Where I had to stand up and be, you know, almost the figurehead of my family. And I'm like, I don't know what's going on or what I'm ever doing, but I'm just going to kind of do it. Exactly. The fake it till you make it part, you know. You know, really stood out. And the fact that she really did do anything that she could for those women, you know, she was like, no, this is, and the way she kind of put her foot down was like, all of this oppression is over. It's done with. You come out of the basement, you go over here, you do what you want, take off your mask and like live your life, ladies, like have a nice day. Like that's kind of the way she like just put her foot down and that was it. All of the oppression was gone. And like you said, B, like she, you know, she was just a really strong character and a really strong woman and what, you know, she did, even though she really felt that she didn't know what she was doing and she did it anyway because she knew that they needed her, you know, was a super, super wonderful part of this book. And I think, yeah, she's one of the best characters. I do love Gwyneth as well. She was quite, you know, the funny little, like you said, like, just kind of like, I'm going to stab you in the face. Like, you know, I do enjoy that. And sometimes I do get that way. And you guys know, you've talked to me. Sometimes I just want to, like, you know, give people
sometimes
the finger and move
stab
on.
People in the face.
Exactly.
This is why I want to be a unicorn.
Exactly. So we could just stab, we're all unicorns. We're just going to stab them with our horn. So, right. You know, but yeah, so she was also my favorite character of the book. So.
Awesome. So kind of sticking with Gwyneth for a little bit, who do you think was the better role model for Gwyneth? Would it have been Eve or would it have been Marinor, or is it somebody else entirely? Because obviously she's, you know, she's kind of the youngest princess and she's got some growing up to do and she kind of needs someone to look up to. So who Bronwyn, would you have kind of picked as her best role model?
Well, I mean, like, obviously I'm a both kind of girl, you know, I don't like to choose if I don't have to, because I feel like there's value in both. I think, you know, Eve was impressive in terms of, you know, she was locked in a tower for 6 years and instead of going completely bonkers, she wrote letters to and from the townsfolk and still managed to be part of her community and, you know, really managed to maintain a weirdly positive attitude and outlook, even towards her sister, who is kind of a dick to her sometimes.
Just because she put a two-headed snake in the basket.
I mean, you know.
That she then kept as a pet, though.
She, you know, so that actually turned out to be kind of kind. But, you know, I think Eve does have a lot to offer, but if I had to really choose, you know, who would edge the other out, I would say Marinor. Just because she has been such a good leader for everybody, but also because she has the benefit of not having been raised by the evil king, you know, so there's that level of not being effed up by your parents the same way.
True. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, and we try not to pass down some of those psychoses if we can avoid it. I mean, I feel like both of them have a lot to offer in terms of mentorship and role model kind of and role, you know, behavior modeling for Gwyneth. So I think she's in a good place with people who can provide that for her. So
What about you, Jess?
You know, I think both of them both have their strengths, you know, as role models and being a sister, an older sister, you know, I've kind of always had that, you know, that notion in the back of my mind that my sister is looking up to me, and she definitely does, you know, and that you're a role model as a sister. And where, you know, like Bronwyn said, you know, maybe it's not good because she was like locked in a tower and raised by the evil king, but also it may be good for her to have her sister as a role model because they both had grown up under his reign. You know, they can both connect to each other with that. And there is a couple like moments in this book where they do, and where she does tell her about her mom, or where she does tell her about like things that had gone on, or they talk about her father and how, you know, they both feel about their father. So I think it's important for Eve to be a role model for her just as much as it is for the king to be a role model to her as well. There's also like a sweet scene between the two of them where they're like standing and talking to one another about like, you know, like what they have to do and that type of deal. And I think they both have their moments with her. So, yeah, I'm with B. I'm not choosing either or, but I think both of them are important. And I think as role models, they can both do their parts for Gwyneth.
Awesome. I'll be honest, it was kind of a bit of a trick question, because even as I was writing it, I was thinking of that expression they say, it takes a village to raise a child.
Yes, and it does.
And I think everybody who's now present, you know, has some kind of input that will be positive, even Riddick by the end of it. Yeah. But they all have some kind of positive input. But also the fact that Gwyneth is no longer the, you know, the child of the king, I think it will have an important effect on her, because she no longer has to think, who do I have to marry? What responsibilities will I have? That kind of thing. So in a way, for her, a weight has kind of almost been lifted. But if we stick with Eve for a second and go all the way back to issue one, obviously she gets rescued from her tower and she cuts all her hair off. Now, what to you was the significance of Eve cutting her hair off? Bronwyn, do you want to kind of take the lead on that one?
Sure. To me, her cutting her hair off was like shedding the shackles that chained her. You know, the image of the perfect princess that her father was forcing on her was as much a part of her prison as the tower. So her shedding her hair and her dress was her way of leaving all of that control behind and moving forward into a life of her own choosing. You know, like he raised her as a person until she was 12. And then as soon as he decided that her being a princess was more important than her being Eve, he put her in a tower to preserve her purity because he didn't trust her. You know, he didn't value her as a person. He just valued her chastity. He didn't value her input or her thought processes or anything. He just didn't value her at all, really, at the end of the day. And so all he wanted was that picture, you know, that pretty girl with long hair in a long dress who was, quote unquote, with giant air quotes, innocent. I mean, I don't know how innocent you can actually be when your father has locked you in a tower. I feel like your innocence is then lost because now you've seen that your father is not perfect. And that to me is the death of childhood, you know, is when you have to face the fact that your parents aren't perfect. maybe I'm looking too far into this, but anyway, I do think that the shedding of her hair and her dress is her deciding for herself what her image is going to be and what her future is and what her story is.
Yeah, I think I agree with that because, you know, there's that cliche of going through a breakup and then getting your hair cut, or, you know, having your hair cut off being a traumatic experience. And I've had long hair for most of my life, but I did have it cut incredibly short once. And it is actually quite traumatizing. I know it sounds ridiculous, maybe not in the grand scheme of things, but going from having very long hair halfway down my back to having a hairdresser cut my hair more than I wanted him to, as an act of revenge against somebody, ridiculous as that sounds, this is a genuine thing that happened to me. You know, it was traumatizing. And I think if you choose to do that the way that Eve chooses to do it, I think she does it as quite a sort of a cathartic thing, almost saying, you know, I've got power over myself.
I'm
making this choice for me. Nobody has got agency over me anymore. I am my own person. Does that kind of fit with what you were thinking, Jess? Or
yeah, pretty much. I mean, this is a little cliche for me. I'm not gonna lie. This one part, I was a little like, oh, she cuts her hair off and changes her outfit. Like, it's a very stereotypical, like, you know, kind of like princess story. You know, like we've seen it before. Like, you know. And I was a little like, ah, but I get it. And that's what it's supposed to do. Again, we talked about some of the stuff being a little hit you over the head with it. And this definitely is one of those. And I do think, you know, I think we do it naturally, though. I know, like you said, you cut your hair off. Like, I've cut my hair off, like, you know, I mean, I remember when I shaved the side of my head off, like, that was very freeing. That was, like, liberating. I was like, yes, I like, you know, like, buzzer to the head was quite a very liberating feeling, you know. It was very interesting. And I actually really did enjoy it. It wasn't, you know, I enjoyed that. That for me was like, a, you know, kind of like a breath of fresh air. It was a total new hairstyle. Gave me a little bit of life, you know. So, yeah. So, no, I totally agree with it. But like I said, it was a little cliche for me. Just a little.
Yeah.
That one was a little cliche. Yeah.
I thought it might also be a throwback to the fact that she starts off singing the song from Tangled.
Yes.
Yeah. And I thought that
anyone,
too.
Yes. Anyone who has seen Tangled knows that at the end, you know, she cuts all the hair off.
Yeah. Well, and I mean Rapunzel in the tower, right? So
yes. Yeah, Rapunzel in the tower. Yeah, exactly. So you know, I thought it went along, but yeah, just a little cliche on that one.
Well, that's fine. We can have the odd cliche. We'll accept that. Awesome. Well, that kind of that covers off all the questions that I had. So was there anything that I haven't talked about that you ladies kind of wanted to raise? Is there anything that you think I've missed? Because I might have written a huge list of questions, but I always miss something.
I don't think that's possible with the amount of questions that you did.
I really don't.
I don't think I could pick something else out if I wanted to.
Awesome. Well, in that case, as anybody who has listened to us before knows, we like to kind of share a few things that if you enjoyed Lady Castle, you might also like. Obviously, we're going to recommend the entire Princeless universe from Jeremy Whitley and friends, because, you know, Princeless is all about saving yourself and rejecting the reality that your stupid king father has for you. So obviously, if you somehow haven't read Princeless or any of the books in that universe, please do. We also wanted to recommend Scales and Scoundrels from Sebastian Gerner and Galad, because that's in the same kind of ballpark, maybe not with sort of as many of the kind of feminist tropes, but in that kind of like fantasy. So I can hear Jess getting excited because she loves Scales and Scoundrels.
I love Scales.
It's a very, it's a really, very good book.
Yeah, it's really good. I love it. Love that book.
Obviously, we've talked about kind of Disney movies and princess movies, and not all of those are very good representations of feminism, I'm going to be honest. However, Tangled does all right for itself, I would say. Beauty and the Beast has its moments, and also The Princess and the Frog. I love The Princess and the Frog, and I will use any opportunity to recommend people watch it. For more of the kind of, you know, princesses that maybe don't fit into the classic laying around waiting for a prince to come along and kiss them, slightly weird consent issues.
Frozen, also a decent one.
Frozen is also a good one. And also, if you're looking for comic books for younger readers, I would also recommend the Disney Frozen comic books, because they are all lovely and adorable, and the art is really, really cute. And they just have quite nice stories in them, and they're good for kind of younger readers that maybe aren't kind of as into some of the other things that we'd recommend. So those are quite good. Also, the DC Superhero Girls books and the cartoon that goes with them as well. I would highly recommend those for kind of younger readers. And we also wanted to recommend Gloria O'Brien's History of the Future by A.S. King. So anyone who heard our third episode will know how much we enjoyed that book. And again, it kind of has those themes of shaping your own future and making your own decisions in life. So if you haven't read that, or if you haven't listened to that episode, please do go and check out the book and the podcast. So I think that's a wrap for this time. I hope that you've enjoyed spending some time with us. We'd love to have you back next time. Next month, we will be taking a deep dive into the 2018 Netflix original movie To All the Boys I've Loved Before, based on the novel series by Jenny Han and starring Lana Condor, Noah Centineo, Anna Cathcart and Israel Broussard. It's a bit of a change from what we would normally look at. But the first time I watched it, I was kind of coming up with some issues and some theories around it. So I think that'll be quite an interesting one. So please do check that out before next month. If you have got anything you'd like to talk to us about regarding Lady Castle or To All the Boys I've Loved Before, which I'm now regretting suggesting as a topic because it's got a really long title.
Not as bad as Squirrel Girl, though.
You can find us on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook. We are at Valhalla Ladies, or you can email ladiesofvalhalla@gmail.com. You can also see our beautiful logo on all of our social media as designed by our very own Lady J. So, Lady B, where can our lovely listeners find you?
You can find me at Shiny Baby B on all the things.
And Lady J, where can you be found?
I am at Jarska at all the things.
Personally, I can be found everywhere that media is social under the name Geek Country Lady. Don't forget to check out talkingcomicbooks.com for news, reviews and articles about comics, video games, TV shows and more. We also have podcasts of every flavour, including Talking Valiant, Bendis Assembled, Adventure the D&D podcast and Talking Comics, which if you haven't heard enough of Jess and I, you can hear us sharing a seat every other week on Talking Comics. Thank you once more and we'll be back in your ears again soon.
Sorry.
I think they agree with you.
Yes. Yeah. Do you agree?
Amazing.
Yeah, there you go.
Sorry,
it's okay. We'll cut this.
While the dogs are barking.
Yeah, just cut this out. I've been trying to mute them. I don't know what they're doing. What are you doing over there?
Sorry, I'll edit out you having your breakdown. All my congestions has come back into my nose and I can't breathe now. It's horrible.
Oh, no.
Okay, I'm having a bloody nose right now, so I'm trying to quietly stop it up.
Oh, no. What's wrong with us?
I don't know.
Why are we all so broken?
I think it comes from being nerds.
Is that what it is? True. Like, we're just doomed. Like, you know, like, I always, like... nerd stereotypes, but there I am with my inhaler and like 17 different kinds of allergy medication, you know? I'm right. Like, well, you know.
I got my nasal spray, my allergy.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
I am afraid that might actually be what it is. We live, you know, quite fairly indoor lifestyles and we do nerdy things and we stare at screens a lot.
I play hockey, I go to the gym, like, come on.
No, I can't even say I do that. I don't leave the house, okay?
I've literally had a text from my former trainer while I've been recording with you saying, haven't seen you at the gym for a while. Aww. And I'm like, I've got a chest infection.
Sorry.
Maybe. Right.
Oh my God, please include them.
You want my sarcastic yay me?
Yep, I do.
Okay, are we back in the room?
Yeah, I think we're
right.
We're all here. Oh, sorry. I apologize. I don't know what just happened. I just
you coughed.
But like it like caught me off guard. You coughed. I hate you. If I wish I could throw, I really would because it caught me way off guard. Anyway.
That bit I'll edit out.
If I could throw something at you, I totally would, but I love it.
I'm poorly. You have to be nice to me.
Oh, she whined.
Don't be nice to me. I'm not very well.
Oh, Muffin.
Don't you. Okay, you can continue now.
What were we talking about?
You were talking about who was the better role model for you.
Okay, so